Hello again and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy. And this weekly, Hamlet walks the walls of Derry, care of Stage Beyond Theatre Company. We hear about some of the things getting up the nose of Maurice Gohan. We take a voyage into the music of Sun Ra, and Paddy Woodworth wants to make it clear there are other books by Rachel Carson, author of Silent Spring. But first, after months of rehearsal, COVID-19 looked like putting an end to the latest from Stage Beyond, a Derry-based theatre company for adults with learning difficulties. The company spent the winter rehearsing Hamlet, Prince of Derry, an update of the play by Colin Murphy, directed by Conal Morrison, only to have lockdown bring things to a sudden halt. But this Sunday evening, the show will go on as a radio play for RTE's Drama on One, created during lockdown in rooms all over the Northwest, using all the tools the online world has to offer. I spoke to the company's artistic director, Dee Conaghan, in one of those rooms, about how radio
recording
saved the day.
Hi everyone, this is Hamlet. It's been a long month. Sorry I haven't been on. Thanks for the messages.
Welcome to Mortal Coil.
I thought I'd play through some of my favourite game, Mortal Coil, and try and lift my mood. If you like this, don't forget to subscribe.
I am in an absolute madhouse, I have to tell you. I have our back garden, the plumbing is completely gone, the kitchen sink's gone, we've no toilet. So there's like stuff over, you're not allowed to use the sink, and I've just poured half a pot of tea down it, and I've just had someone shouting at me for doing that.
Let the game begin.
My name is Dee Conaghan. I am the artistic director of Stage Beyond Theatre Company, a theatre company that's based in the Northwest in the Millennium Forum for adults with learning difficulties. We started off actually with 11 members, and we now have over nearly 40 company members. We have just started a company actually in Letterkenny as well, and we have quite a long waiting list of members that hope to join. It started out, we would have worked in a lot, as we still do in schools and colleges, but now we are really kind of reaching out into the whole of the island, and we have a very big kind of touring remit, which obviously this year did not happen for obvious reasons. But now we have great links with, say, the Abbey, the Lyric, and we would do kind of co-productions with them and work with artists and facilitators. So it's got much bigger. But playwright Colin Murphy came to work with us. He adapted Hamlet with a very kind of Derry take on it.
Guildhall Square.
Nothing.
Where is it?
Patience, my lord.
Camera 2, Castle Gate. Camera 3, Butcher's Gate.
Look, my lord, it comes.
Angels and ministers of grace defend us.
Casting happened between Letterkenny and Derry. Colin Murphy and also our director, Conal Morrison, went to Angreenan in Letterkenny, where they auditioned company members there. They then went to the Millennium Forum, and it was just like a real, you know, open audition, and people they went through lines, they went through kind of workshops, and both Conal and Colin then cast from there. So we have a fabulous Hamlet, Oisin, playing Hamlet, with Ophelia, played by Isabel. It's an hour long, and it's very kind of contemporary, with Call of Duty in it and gaming. We have gamers in it. It's a fabulous, very inventive as a production, and would have been extremely exciting to watch on stage.
Are you a deep fake or the walking dead? You come in such a questionable shape that I will speak to you. I'll call you Hamlet, King, Father, Dairyman. Answer me!
It wants to speak to you, as if I had something to say to you alone.
Well, of course.
My phone.
Like everyone else, we were kind of hearing, you know.
Father?
It was almost like kind of creeping down the road that this was coming. But we literally were in the Millennium Forum on a Monday, I think, very much in March. And the chief executive came along and said, you know what? We are closing this afternoon. And so the company, we all left. And from then on, we knew this is kind of highly unlikely. At one point, we thought, well, maybe we could do part of it. We could do it, you know, maybe in Letterkenny, we might not get to Dublin. But then just very soon, it just transpired that just nothing was going to happen. And so we just had to cancel all. We had, you know, Dublin, Letterkenny and Belfast and Derry. So we were just absolutely devastated that it wasn't going to happen. And then we thought, well, maybe it'll happen in September. But then, of course, that's not even going to happen. So it's just had to shelve it.
What a piece of work is man.
Man, that's heavy. He needs some kittens in there. Don't forget to like and subscribe if you want these videos to keep coming.
So when did the radio idea turn up?
Kevin Brew, a producer, RTE, had been with the company, and he had originally talked about doing a very short documentary about Stage Beyond and what we do and, you know, who we work with. And and I think Colin Murphy as well had the conversation about that, wouldn't it be great if we could do something? And then he just rang and said, well, you know, guess what, Dee? We're thinking of putting this out as a drama. But there was things that were just really kind of logistical things. For instance, our Hamlet lived out in the wilds of Donegal, and he had no access to Wi-Fi or no access. He hadn't got a tablet or something. And we, because of the travel restrictions, we weren't able to get over the border. So we were kind of smuggled. We were kind of doing a wee bit of our old-fashioned smuggling over the border with, you know, with computers and whatever.
Fatality.
And yet, to me, what is this quintessence of dust?
People could actually do it from the comfort of their own home. There was one, actually, the guy who plays Hamlet. To get to Derry, he has to walk, I think, a mile and a half to get to his first bus. And then he gets another bus in. And certainly when we were rehearsing during the winter, it was quite hard going for him to actually get to us. There was something quite nice, I'm sure, being able to do it in the comfort of your own home.
There are not two men living with whom he more agrees.
Spend time with him. Try to help him relax.
See if he will tell you what is wrong.
And if he does.
So that was an obvious kind of benefit. But I think it's just to do something kind of quite different. And the fact that we were faced with the news, this wasn't going to happen. And then it did happen. So I think that was just, you know, exciting for everybody in the company.
Thank you, Your Majesties.
Dee Conaghan there, and you can hear Hamlet, Prince of Derry on RTE Radio 1's Drama on One slot at 8 p.m. this coming Sunday, 26th of July, and as a podcast after that. The American scientist and writer Rachel Carson is largely known for her chilling eco-warning Silent Spring, which first appeared in 1962. But there are many other spines on the shelf bearing Carson's name, such as the book she published about her nature explorations with her nephew, A Sense of Wonder, which Paddy Woodworth takes down, this time from the Naturalist bookshelf.
For many years, I knew Rachel Carson's work only through her classic 1962 environmental polemic, Silent Spring. And you cannot talk about Carson, an exceptional naturalist and writer and a reluctant activist, without name-checking this world-changing exposé. She revealed in detail the catastrophic damage the pesticide industry, and especially DDT, inflicts on the natural world and on human health. When her biographer, Linda Lear, compares her impact on our epoch to the influence of books by Karl Marx and Charles Darwin, by Adam Smith and Harriet Beecher Stowe on earlier eras, she's not exaggerating, certainly not very much. Silent Spring immediately attracted gallons of vitriol from the kind of scientists for hire who have since defended the tobacco and fossil fuel industries so effectively. And Carson was vulnerable because she had no powerful university affiliation to back her up, because she was a scientist who wrote in a language the rest of us could easily grasp, and above all, because she was a woman. Why, a former US Secretary of Agriculture asked out loud, was a spinster with no children so interested in genetics? But the book quickly became a bestseller. President Kennedy was moved by its arguments. And yes, for younger listeners, I should point out that once upon a time, the United States had presidents who could read books and even understand them. It was warmly endorsed by Kennedy's Science Advisory Committee within 18 months of its publication, though it took the US another 8 years to ban DDT. So, was the book a success? Yes, and no, and yes again. Globally and locally, we have continued to pump chemicals into our ecosystems. But Carson set so much of the agenda for the environmental movement. It is quite extraordinary how prescient, how contemporary, much of Silent Spring seems today. But I was also faintly aware that there were other dimensions to Rachel Carson. I knew that she had written The Sea Around Us, an invaluable introduction to marine life. But I hadn't taken in, until Richard Nairn, author of Ireland's Coastline, kindly lent them to me recently, that she had written two other exquisitely readable and delightfully illustrated books on the complex web of marine life and ocean dynamics. Under the Sea Wind and The Edge of the Sea could both do a lot to enhance all our seaside staycations this summer. But it was only when I had the privilege of walking the woods of the Cumberland Plateau in Tennessee with George David Haskell, author of The Forest Unseen and The Song of Trees, that I learned about the little jewel I'd particularly like to leave with you this evening. We were discussing a question that exercises every environmentalist. How can those of us who find solace in the natural world and fear for its future pass on these pleasures and these concerns to future generations? Somewhat to my surprise, Haskell recommended a short essay by Carson, A Sense of Wonder, as essential reading. In Silent Spring, despite its occasional lyricism, I'd always thought of Carson as having a somewhat straight-laced approach to nature writing. Had I read her marine trilogy earlier, I would have realised how wrong I was. The bones of these books are formed by ecological information, but their flesh and blood grow from the exultant fusion of sensual and spiritual pleasure that she experiences in her encounters with living creatures and natural phenomena. In A Sense of Wonder, she communicates this ecstasy very directly through a series of happy outings, often nocturnal, with her little nephew, Roger. She started him off very early. When he was about 20 months old, she writes, I wrapped him in a blanket and carried him down to the beach in the rainy darkness. Out there, just at the edge of where we couldn't see, big waves were thundering in, dimly seen white shapes that boomed and shouted and threw great handfuls of froth at us. Together, we laughed for pure joy. This essay is packed with gentle, practical advice for parents and teachers, showing us how to use all our senses to stimulate youthful exploration of the natural world. Once again, Carson was well ahead of her time. Her core point is that you do not need to worry about teaching children the names of plants or birds or animals. Just introduce them to whatever is in your neighbourhood, and their own curiosity will leave them to learn a little about natural history with pleasure. And as they come to love what they meet through the lens of wonder, they will come to care about its condition. We move from the senses to the emotions to the intellect, and all three are surely entwined in a mature, rewarding relationship with nature.
Paddy Woodworth there on Rachel Carson's A Sense of Wonder, his copy of which is the 1997 edition by HarperCollins with photos by Nick Kelsch. And next on the Culture File Weekly, we're off again to Saturn and environs in the company of the late great jazz composer Sun Ra and his current disciple on Earth, DJ and record label boss Giles Peterson. Officially, Ra was born Herman Poole Blount in Birmingham, Alabama on May 22, 1914, but after he changed his name to Ra in 1952, he insisted that he was in fact from Saturn. The composer and band leader headed back in the direction of Saturn in 1993, but since then his legacy has been kept alive by his touring band, The Orchestra. One great point of entry into the music is via the choices of DJ and eternal tastemaker Giles Peterson, who spoke to me about the life, music and astral voyages of Sun Ra.
I remember when I was growing up in South London, there was a new library that just got built called Sutton Library, and they had a record department, and they had a really good selection of records in there. And I used to go in there and pick up stuff that I kind of recognised and odd records that looked a little bit more interesting. And that's probably when I first saw and listened to Sun Ra, back when I was about 15, 14 years old. I eventually got a couple of his records as I started DJing, and I found that even though I didn't really understand the music particularly, there was always some really good effects and spoken word bits. So I used to use those to sort of link the music I was playing as a DJ. So they were kind of almost jingles. And it wasn't until a bit later on that I really started delving into the music itself. It was actually John Peel that put me onto some of the really early Sun Ra material. I was doing a radio show after him back in the day on Radio 1, and he knew I was a fan. And one night he came into the studio after his show. He didn't often do that. And he just said, "I've got a little something for you." And it was an original 7-inch on Saturn of the song called Dreaming.
I'm always trying to kind of work out what the roots are. You do hear that combination of a world that you sort of know and is familiar and cuddly in a way, but with these shards of something kind of astral breaking through every now and then.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think already there was a use of reverb that he was already interested in that made it already a little bit different. And I believe he was playing keyboards on that song, on Dreaming. So the feeling, if you're really careful and you look into it deeply, you can probably see there's a little connection there and where he went on to from that point. And hopefully on the album, we touch some of that. I think some of his early jazz records and already, you know, the use of vocals, limited use of vocals, you could see there was a little bit of that doo-wop in there, but he was already getting into his more spaced out material by then.
Was in some ways led by the instruments, because he was quite interested in what new instruments and new technology might do to his music.
He was the first, or one of the very first, to be experimenting, I believe. It's interesting right now when you go back and you listen to some of the songs and you're like, that was recorded in 1959. That was at least 5 or 6 years ahead of everybody else. So, yeah, I don't know what it was. He was ahead of the game for sure. I don't think he was ever completely accepted by the jazz scene at the time. He was on his own mission, and I think he was just quietly confident that everybody would come round to it at one stage, like we are right now. I think he did actually announce on some songs back in the day that people would eventually come round to his music.
In a way, he made it very hard for people to take him seriously within jazz because he played up the astral side of things, worked so much with costumes, and almost it seemed like deliberately made a kind of an unserious persona for himself.
I remember when he used to come to London, I used to go to see him at Ronnie Scott's. He used to do a residency every year there for a couple of weeks, and I'd make sure I was going to be down there for as many nights as possible. And one of the unsaid rules of signing to my record label, talking out at the time, was to invite all the artists that were about to sign and make sure that they heard Sun Ra, because for me, he presented performance in a new dimension. It wasn't just jazz, it was also theatre, it was also make-believe. And that's possibly why he wasn't taken seriously. But equally, it was really something that opened up a whole different audience for him.
I'm always wondering to what degree was he serious about it? I mean, you know, the idea that he used to say he was from outer space himself and that this mythology he brought around it. At some level, that's good showmanship, but at another level, I wondered how much he believed it.
I think he fully believed it, and I think that there is some otherness about him. I've had so many experiences playing his music or hearing stories from the musicians about being in his band, and it wasn't as much of a myth in a way. I believe that, I mean, you know, obviously I'm not saying that he comes from Saturn, but I think he certainly had sunlight in outer space. A wider view of life, and he had a very visionary view of life. And for me as a DJ, I always carry his music, even if I'm not necessarily going to play it, because it always saves me. If ever I'm going through a moment of doubt in my set or I'm feeling that I'm losing my focus, I usually play a bit of Sun Ra just to straighten me out a little bit. He has that added power somehow. Sunrise in outer space.
Love for everybody. Giles Peterson there, and Giles Peterson's choice of the best of Sun Ra can be found on Sun Ra and His Orchestra, To Those of Earth and Other Worlds, which is on Strut Records. And finally this week, the very latest audio epistle from writer and comedian Maurice Gohan. And this time Maurice has been worrying about cancel culture and once more asking the important questions, like, what's that smell?
I'm still living on the farm. I spent 20 minutes this morning searching for a gone-off egg in my room, convinced I had let one slip somewhere, until my boyfriend told me the horrific stench was in fact slurry, and I realised I don't carry eggs around in my pockets anyway. 3 months in and I'm still not used to that smell. Maybe I should try cancel it. Hashtag cancel slurry. We're in the midst of a social pandemic, along with the actual proper one. We are cancelling the world and its mother. Cancel culture is a type of public shaming, when someone does or says something we consider wrong, and certain groups of people do everything in their power to boycott that person and put pressure on anyone affiliated with them to do the same. And in return, they get a sweet dripping morsel of holier-than-thou cake. It's a powerful tool. Look, we're living in a world where a lot of young people have lost faith in the legal system and the police force and all the institutions supposed to protect us. So we've taken it into our own hands in a very Robin Hood-esque manner. And look, some people deserve to be cancelled. Murderers and paedophiles and rapists, for example. People that say, I just can't gain weight. People who don't give that courtesy hand gesture when you let them pass on a narrow road. True monsters deserve to be publicly shamed. But then we get trigger happy. We do, as humans, love to watch something burn to the ground. We spent most of human existence killing things, eating the raw carcasses with our teeth, killing each other and running around with a head on a stick, and getting scurvy because we didn't have fresh fruit. Basically, we were busy killing, being killed, and avoiding oranges. And then something happened. The Industrial Revolution, the Beatles, the Saipan incident. Something monumental happened. And now we all sit in our bums every day in small rooms and then walk out of them at 5 p.m. and get into small moving rooms and sit our bums there until we stop driving and turn our key into another small room and sit on our now quite numb bums on a comfier chair for the rest of the evening. We are restless. This isn't what we were programmed to do. So, some of us watch a boxing match, some of us go to the butchers, and some of us cancel people on social media. We're all chasing the same high. We want to see some blood. So, once we've cancelled the Epsteins and the Gary Glitters, we keep going. Because we want more. And then it goes into murkier waters. Someone makes an off-colour joke on Twitter and they're out of a job by the end of the day. Teenagers sing along to rap songs and don't skip on the N-word, and their college offers are rescinded. I'm not saying their behaviour is acceptable, but when we decide we're judge, jury and executioner based off a snapshot of someone, we are deciding the intentions behind their actions. And in doing that, we risk ruining the lives of decent people who made bad decisions. And that is catastrophic. Who of us hasn't messed up at some stage? Who hasn't said the wrong thing? Who of us hasn't meant one thing, but someone else took it as another? Why are we so quick to throw someone in the bin instead of seeing if they could be repaired? I treat my clothes better than we treat each other. If we don't give people the opportunity to grow, we as a society are doomed. If we throw enough people in the bin, there won't be any of us left. And I truly believe people can be better than they were yesterday. Instead of deciding to ruin someone's life, we should be teaching them to be better. Attacking someone will always cause a defensive reaction. No learning comes from it. We've watched enough Vincent Brown debates to know this to be true. But empathy, it often breeds more empathy. Look, we have the capacity to do bad things because we are human. We also have the capacity to be better because we are human. Except for Piers Morgan or Gemma O'Doherty, there's no redemption in those two. Really? Why aren't we cancelling them?
Maurice Gohan there on refining the aim of cancel culture. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more memorable odours next Friday at 7. Till then, bye now.